to the second half of Shattering Myths. I am your host, Yada. As we turn the page, we're going to return to our evaluation of Yah's Torah teaching. We want to gain an understanding of his perspective on his Torah so that we are in a position to properly evaluate who he is, what he is offering, and how we should respond. In doing so, we have, over these past few days, been considering Marsal. Marsal are word pictures. And these word pictures most often are written from the perspective of the father, and in most all of them, the father is our heavenly father. From the perspective of the mother, when the mother is mentioned, it is our spiritual mother, the set-apart spirit. And it is almost always directed to their children, which would be the children of the covenant. In this particular case, the Torah is presented the same way Yahusha presents himself. It reads, "The Torah is light. It is the way of life." Yahusha said that he was the light of the world. He said of himself that he was the way. He said that he was the life. Here, Yahweh, as the Father, is saying that his Torah is the light, is the way, is the source of life. It is not coincidence that Yahusha and the Torah are viewed as providing the exact same things. Yahusha walked directly out of the pages of the Torah. If you do not see Yahusha as walking out of the pages of the Torah, as representing the Torah, as being the living manifestation of Yahweh's Torah, then you do not know him. Because he is and was all of these things. Another proverb, this Marsal or word picture, begins in the first verse of the seventh proverb. It reads, again, this being our heavenly Father speaking to his children, the covenant children. He says, "My son, my child, choose to actually observe." Now, God did not say, "Son, choose to obey." He did not say, "My son, I command you to do as I have ordered." He did not say, "My son, kowtow to me, capitulate, surrender your free will." No, our Heavenly Father says, "My son, choose to actually observe." This was a Shemar. It's elect to focus upon, carefully examine, diligently consider, and thoughtfully evaluate. Agree to pay a close attention to, and genuinely care about. Now, the inferences of things, for example, like choose and actually, associated with observe and examine and consider, are derived from the fact that this was written in the call imperative, indicating that an actual relationship will be established between the father and son should this child choose of their own volition to pay attention to this exhortation to focus upon the father's words. "My son, choose to actually observe my words, my emir, my answers, my explanations, and my promises." And it is interesting to note here that while there are many Hebrew words for word, like debar is the most prominent Hebrew word for word, emir is one that takes a slightly different shading than debar. Its primary unique shading is that it would say, "My son, choose to actually consider my answers, my explanations." Its third connotation then that would differentiate it somewhat from debar would be "my promises." Although there is a Hebrew word that for word that emphasizes promises over answers and explanations. So here, the emphasis should be, "My son, choose to actually consider my answers, my explanations." That's what the Torah teaching is all about. The Torah teaching, its instructions and directions provide answers. God wants his children to observe it so that their questions are answered. He goes on to say, this is the Father speaking to his covenant children, and my terms and conditions, my mitzvah, my directions regarding the instructions which pertain to my covenant contract, you should habitually treasure and store with you. This verb is safan. You should value. And it's written here in the call, imperfect, affirming that there is a relationship between us and Yah's terms and conditions, and that that relationship ought to be genuine, because by properly valuing the terms and conditions of the covenant, their influence on our lives will be ongoing, producing eternal results. So, my son, choose to actually observe, focus on, carefully examine, diligently consider my answers, my explanations, and my terms and conditions relative to the covenant contract. You should habitually treasure and store. You should value. God consistently offers this same advice. Observe his word. Value his terms and conditions. So why do you suppose Jews favor their oral law? Why do Christians prefer their New Testament? Why do Muslims recite to their Quran? They all portend that they worship the same God who authored the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. And yet, that God's instructions they routinely and completely ignore. Is that not ignorant? Is that not irrational? Is it not foolish? Excuse me, Hebrew poetry, rather than emphasizing rhythm and rhyme, is comprised of couplets which convey truth from a variety of different perspectives. Each perspective affirming and augmenting the overall message. This next statement is a great example. So, what we should expect in most Hebrew poetry is that the statement that is made in the opening statement, which I've just shared with you, will be repeated in the second statement, but using different words so as to emphasize the message, to affirm the message, and to provide a slightly different perspective on the same teaching. So here's Proverbs, Masal, Word Pictures, 7:2. Choose to keep focused upon, closely examine and carefully consider, Shamar again, my terms and conditions, my instructions regarding the covenant agreement, and live. My Torah teaching should be as the pupil, the center and focus of your eyes, leading to understanding. Reemphasizing what is the single most important part of Yah's Torah, the terms and conditions of his covenant. If you understand Yah's teaching regarding the terms and conditions of his covenant, if you seek his answers there, and know them, understand them, embrace them, act upon them, then everything else falls into place. You become his child. You become immortal. You become perfected. You become empowered, enriched. You receive the benefits of the covenant. So God is telling us not only what to focus on in his Torah, and he's not saying here, you know, what I want you to focus on is not eating shellfish. No. What he consistently says is, what I want you to focus on is the terms and conditions, the mitzvah of the covenant. Understand his terms and conditions. Understand that he has laid out a path that is 7 steps long, that we walk to him, to live with him. Those are the terms and conditions of our salvation, just as there are 5 terms and conditions of this covenant relationship. And so he doesn't say, believe in me. He doesn't say, put your faith in these things. No. He says, focus on them, closely examine them, carefully consider them. Because when you do that, then you're in a position to understand. And when you're in a position to understand, you can exercise free will in a manner that's not capricious, but that is rational, appropriate, purposeful, beneficially exercising your free will. And he says, when you do that, when you keep focused on, when you carefully examine and carefully consider his terms and conditions, you're going to live. And chaya is a marvelous verb. It means to be restored to life, to be renewed, to be nourished and to grow, electing to exist forever. All of that is conveyed by chaya. Chaya, by the way, is written very similarly in Hebrew to haya, which is the basis of Yahweh's name. As a matter of fact, chaya carries the Yah conclusion, just as haya does, which is the opening syllable of God's name. Yahweh, which is based on the verb haya, I exist, I was, I am, I will be, in the first person, is the source of chaya, of being restored and renewed, of being nourished and growing. Yahweh is the source of life, both temporal and eternal. Now, telling us where we would find these answers, where we would find these terms and conditions that we should focus upon, the Father tells his covenant children, my Torah teaching should be as the pupil, the center and the focus of your eyes, leading to understanding. So many times I have shared something that is counter to religious thought. When someone says they are Torah observant, most everyone listening says, oh, they're Jewish. And they're keeping the Torah in the sense of they're doing what the Torah says, that they're fixated with observing the Sabbath and not working on the Sabbath. They're fixated on the dietary laws, that they're obeying the law, and that therefore they are a religious Jew, is what the connotation is for most people when you say, I am Torah observant. But here in this passage, Yahweh proves that that's not the case at all. And it's why we say so many times that observe does not mean keep. It does not mean obey.
On the average.
To Shattering Myths. I'm your host and tour guide through Yah's word, Yada. Yada means to know. It means to know in a relational sense, to recognize, to appreciate, to acknowledge. And in this case, we're acknowledging that Yahweh is God and that he has inspired the scriptures that we are considering. If you disagree, would like to challenge that or have a story to tell in this regard, our number is 877-300-7645. One of the things that is most difficult in terms of conveying Yah's teaching and terms of directing people of where to go to find answers, as this proverb is encouraging us to do, is that the moment you say to observe the Torah, and that is what this is asking us, it tells us what part of the Torah is the most important to observe, but it is asking us to observe the Torah. The moment you say you're a Torah observant, the most people shut down. They say, well, that is a religious Jew obeying the law. Well, here's a newsflash for you. God just said that observing has all to do with keeping the pupil, the center of your eyes, focused. To observe is to focus upon, is to closely examine, to carefully consider, to use your perception of sight to gather information. That's what it means to observe. There is no connotation whatsoever associated with keep, do, or obey associated with observe, other than the subtlety of keeping your eyes focused and keeping paying attention to that which you're observing, in this case, the Torah. It is simply a verb that speaks of using your perception of sight to examine something, focusing on it so that you know what it says in the case of a written document, and you consider what it says. That's what it means to observe. Similarly, shema, which is the other term that Yahweh has used throughout the Proverbs, to speak of Him as our Father encouraging us to listen to Him. Shema is usually rendered in English translations as obey Him. But there is absolutely no connotation whatsoever associated with either of these two verbs that communicates obey. None. And that is because God's not into the obedience business. That's not His thing. He is communicating here as a father to His covenant children. And He is encouraging them to pay attention to His source of answers, to focus upon the terms and conditions associated with life that are found in the Torah. Because He knows that if we examine them, if we care about them, if we pay attention to them, if we disregard the religious and political and academic denials associated with His Torah teaching, His source of answers, and we go directly to Him, cutting out the middlemen, cutting out all the garbage that has been smeared in our faces to preclude us from understanding, if we are willing to push all that away and read His Torah directly, to consider what God Himself had to say, to come to embrace the terms and conditions that are presented in the Torah that are associated with life and the renewal of life, that if we do that, we will live. Because God gave us an asama, a conscience that enables us when we devote the time to gather information and to know what He has to say, our conscience, this seat of exercising good judgment, He knows it will enable those who are thoughtful, who are open, who are receptive, to come to understand what He is offering, and they will respond to God's offer appropriately. God does not have to compel us to love Him. He doesn't have to force us to obey Him. He knows that those who turn to Him for answers, who focus on what He is conveying to us through His Torah teaching, that they'll figure it out. That they'll come to recognize who He is and what He's offering and act upon it, embracing it, and they will therefore live. But in this passage, do not lose track of two things. One is the Father talking to His covenant children, and He is specifically telling us where to turn for answers, number one. Number two, that the thing we should focus on most of all is the terms and conditions of the covenant. Number three, that if we do so, we will live. And number four, we'll find them in the midst of His Torah teaching. And number five, that the definition of observation is to keep the center of your eyes focused so as to know what He had to say. I'm Yada. This is Shattering Myths. Last half hour of Shattering Myths this morning, as we would expect any loving parent to do. Yahweh is not just about the task of encouraging His children to look to Him for answers. He's not just about the task of providing them with good advice and telling them that if they follow His advice that life will be wonderful for them. As a loving father, He must also tell His children the consequence of choosing to ignore His advice, choosing to repudiate His advice. And He must also tell His children that there are lots of people out there that will try to influence him or her in a way that would be counterproductive to their relationship. And He must also tell that child the consequence of siding with them, of being beguiled by them. It is what loving fathers do. And Yah, as a loving father, is no exception in this regard. So here is another word picture. It is Marsal 28:4, another proverb. The father is saying, the wicked arrogantly boast and make fools of themselves by abandoning and rejecting the Torah. Now, think about those who have abandoned and rejected the Torah. All Christians. The essence of Pauline doctrine, the essence of the religion of Christianity, is the replacement of the Torah, which they say cannot save, which they claim is law, that cannot be kept, and therefore cannot save, with the gospel of grace. That is the basis of Christianity. And so, virtually every Christian who has ever lived has been beguiled by the wicked to abandon and reject the Torah. Muslims claim that Allah confirmed the Torah and the Quran, but they only make that claim because they're ignorant of what the Torah says and don't know that the Quran contradicts the Torah in every possible way. So every Muslim who has ever believed Muhammad has abandoned and rejected the Torah, and therefore made arrogant fools of themselves. In socialist secular humanism, the Torah is repudiated. Its God is considered intolerant. And to be intolerant and to be a God is the hathma, the great condemnation of secular humanists. And so it is routinely rejected by men so arrogant they see themselves as the pinnacle of the universe. So God is saying that man's arrogance and his foolishness are all a direct derivative of abandoning and rejecting the Torah, Yah's teaching. He goes on to say, and those who observe, focusing upon the Torah, they take the initiative to oppose them. You know, there is a lot of religious individuals who say that you're being hateful when you point out the shortcomings in people's religious beliefs, when you point out the flaws in people's political and economic conclusions or belief systems. And yet God says that it is appropriate to oppose these things. You see, all of the religions and all of the political schemes of man almost universally, in fact, I should say universally, abandon and reject the Torah. There isn't a human institution that embraces Yah's Torah teaching, not one. So man's religious and political, man's economic institutions, man's military institutions universally abandon and reject the Torah, and God is saying that is what makes them arrogant, boastful, and foolish. And then he tells us that those who observe and focus upon the Torah, those who are Torah observant, they take the initiative to resist them, to oppose them, which is the essence of the first half of this program every day. So rejecting and opposing, being intolerant of human, religious, political, military, and economic schemes is our responsibility. It is a natural outgrowth of coming to know what the Torah teaches. When you know what the Torah teaches, you know that God is opposed to religion, to politics, to patriotism, to being dependent upon one's country, to militarism, and to economic schemes. And that that when you come to observe the Torah, you know that it is your responsibility to oppose these things. And rather than being hateful is the single most loving and compassionate thing one can do. Because these things are not honest. They are not reliable. They are not truthful. The individuals who promote them are halal. That is, the wicked, which is rasa, are halal by azab Torah. is what God says. You know what halal means? Well, first of all, halal is what's considered to be good in Islam. That which is, you know, you've heard of kosher and Judaism. Well, the equivalent of kosher in Judaism is halal. It is that which is pure, that which is in full accord with Allah. Well, halal in Hebrew is arrogant, boasting, and foolishness. It's pretending to be bright and enlightened, however, displaying an improper attitude of haughtiness. Halal just happens to be Satan's first name. It is Halal bin Shakar, as he is named in the prophecies given to Yeshayahu. It means to glorify oneself, to praise oneself, and to mock and slander others. In this case, God. So the wicked, the rasa, those who are condemned and deserved to be punished for having violated the standard, they are halal. They arrogantly boast and make fools of themselves by abandoning and rejecting azab. Azab is about the worst word there is in Hebrew. It means to forsake. It means to separate from. It is to neglect and to disassociate from. It is to depart from and ignore the Torah. If you azab the Torah, Yahuwah azabs you. If you forsake the Torah, you are forsaken by God. If you forsake the Torah, if you abandon the Torah, God sees you as halal. Foolish. Improper. He sees you as mocking and slandering. And while that is extraordinarily relevant and clear, so is this. And those who observe, closely examining and carefully considering the Torah teaching, they take the initiative to resist them. This is garaba. They are overly hostile to them. They provoke them. They actively engage against them. They irritate them. You see, God knows that if we do not speak out against human political and religious schemes, human military and economic schemes, if we simply allow people to be thoughtlessly beguiled by them, if we do nothing to cause people to question their allegiance to these things which are unworthy, then we are not loving. Then we are not compassionate. Then we are not caring. The most impressive way to show that you genuinely care about the fate of others is to expose and condemn the things that they rely upon which are not worthy of their allegiance. And at the same time, to point them to the one individual and one source which is dependable. It is the single most courageous and compassionate thing we can do in this life. It is what Yahusha did routinely. It is what Yahweh does routinely. It isn't enough simply to tell people, here is the consequence, the benefits of coming to know, coming to understand, coming to act upon the terms and conditions of my covenant, and that they are life, perfection, adoption, enrichment and empowerment. It isn't sufficient simply to say, here is all of the good that will come from listening to me, from observing what I have to offer. It isn't enough. Because most human institutions, most countries, most academic facilities, most media outlets, most religions, most militaries, most economic leaders preach something that is the antithesis of Yah's Torah. Since they are opposed to it, it is necessary that people understand that their opposition to the Torah makes them appear foolish and arrogant from God's perspective. It is necessary that people know that by rejecting Yah's teaching, that they are being rejected by God. There's a consequence. There is a choice, and there is a consequence. And all loving fathers share this consequence because they want their sons of their own volition to make the right choice, knowing that they have options that are available to them. In the same proverb we read, evil individuals, those who are malicious and malignant, do not apprehend or teach good judgment. But those who diligently seek Yahweh consider and understand everything. The basis of political correctness, which is the replacement moral code for socialist secular humanism, is not teaching good judgment. This very line describes what's happened to us. In political correctness, as exercising judgment is considered the ultimate sin. We are taught as children in politically correct societies to accept mutually exclusive ideas as all being true. The coexist bumper sticker is the sign on the forehead of those poisoned by political correctness, that they are clueless, that they have been poisoned by this disease and are now incapable of exercising good judgment. God has explained the soil, the poison of political correctness, as well as the antidote. I am Yada. This is Shattering Myths. We'll be back with our conclusions in a moment. Back to Shattering Myths. I am your host, Yada. We had a caller who just wanted to ask a question who has since hung up, and we have Larry also on the line. The question from the caller was, and the caller's name was Yare. He said, did the pharaohs know the name of the Hebrew God? Of course, my first reaction to that is that there is but one God. He has but one name. He is no more the Hebrew God than he is the God of everyone. And so did the pharaohs know Yahweh's name, which would be his one and only name? And while I don't think it is relevant as to whether or not they knew his name or not, because Pharaoh considered himself a god. He considered Ra to be the head of the Egyptian pantheon. The reality is that that Moshe, who was asked by Yahweh to go back to Egypt to work with him to convey his message and also scribe his Torah, that Moshe was introduced to God by name. Yahweh told Moshe that when the children of Yisrael ask you what is the name of the God who is offering to save them, you should tell them that Yahweh is my name, that it is my only name and the way that I wish to be recalled and remembered. And so the children of Yisrael were absolutely told that God's name is, was, and always will be Yahweh.
And if the Egyptians knew the name, they didn't know him.
Yeah, it's like okay, if you know the name of the of Dionysus, how is that helpful? You know, I can say, all right, did Moses know the name Osiris? Well, yeah, probably did know the name Osiris. Does that mean that he knew Osiris? Well, no, because Osiris was mythical.
And
yeah, it didn't exist. I can tell you most certainly that that Pharaoh and the Egyptians came to know that Yahweh exists, whether or not they knew him by name.
The rough way.
Yeah, whether or not they knew his name or not.
No, you're taking with the Egyptians personally.
No. You know, what's interesting about that whole story, though, and one of the things that I just always thought was provocative about Iowa, and particularly even as he would write his 10 statements in stone, is the overall fixation on his role in this one-time event of freeing the children of Israel from Egypt to honor a promise that he had made to Abraham regarding the covenant. And so, you know, why does God continue to repeat that? You know, if God's crowning achievement were going to be, you know, from the Christian perspective, dying on a cross, which, of course, didn't occur, but should that have been his crowning achievement, why every time he introduces himself or chisels something in stone, why is he so repetitive about the role that he played in honoring the covenant's promise to save his children from religious and political oppression in Mitzrayim, the crucible of Egypt?
Which is really what the promise is about, because that's about the covenant.
Yeah, well, you know, you finally realize it, that everything that is in essence of what God's promised to do for us relative to the covenant is conveyed by the Exodus. He's saving his children from religious and political and economic and military oppression, from the institutions of man, taking them away from the institutions of man to live with him in his home, and is doing so by the seven steps that are described as the Mikra, the invitations to meet with God, which begin with Passover and end with Sukkah, with camping out with him. It is a historical model of his promise to us.
So it worked just like the way he walked Abraham out of what? The most religious and political place on the planet at that time, which was Babylon.
So
that was the start to everybody's relationship.
Yeah, the relationship that he formed with Abraham by asking him to walk away from his country and to walk with him to his home in the promised land is identical to what occurred during the Exodus. It's the exact same story.
Too, wouldn't it?
Only if you wish to engage in a relationship with God. Something that is your choice, we hope that you make it, but the covenant has but one path to God, just as there is but one God. And to focus on what the Torah teaches regarding its terms and conditions is essential if you want to live with Him. I am Yada. This is Shattering Myths. Thank you, Larry, for calling in.
Hi, I'm Dr. Joel Wallach, the Dead Doctors Don't Lie guy. There's no reason why you shouldn't live to be at least 100 and have a great time getting there. And I'm going to give you a free copy of my lecture.